Hello, and welcome to the show. My name is Donovan Morgan Grant, and I am joined by Mr. Harrison Chute.
Hello.
And this is Questions We Don't Have Answers. The two of us have been podcasting for some years now. Harry's been analyzing sci-fi on a social-political scale, and I've done shows on superhero comic books and superhero comic book media. So we've been in the podcasting game for a while, but thought we'd like to up our ante and try to talk about things that really matter. Things that people try to talk about but tend not to. Sociology, society, culture, race.
We need food.
So the purposes of this podcast is to have as honest and uncompromising a discussion as humanly possible. So hopefully this podcast will
explode
the world.
Broaden your mindset and give way to critical thinking, because critical thinking is where it all begins. So sit back, enjoy, and give us your thoughts once you hear our takes on the subject matters of today. Welcome back to Questions We Don't Have Answers. As always, I am Donovan, and as ever, I'm joined by my friend and yours, Mr. Harrison Harry Chute.
Why?
Which I'm sure that's your middle name.
So
we're going to get into a sleazy indulgence of my comic books in a bit. But I thought it's one of those, you know, in the news kind of things that we have opinions on. So I thought I would make mention of what's going on right now. And we've mentioned this before in passing in a previous episode, the football protests and now recently more of the sports protests when it comes to like things like soccer and basketball, where athletes are taking a knee when the national anthem is sung in regards to protesting police brutality and death of unarmed black people at the hands of the police, most famously done by Colin Kaepernick. And this past weekend, there's been a brouhaha at the time of this recording. There's been a brouhaha because President Loudmouth has, you know, given his opinion at a rally, basically kind of just jamming up his base, calling them SOBs and saying they should be fired for exercising their constitutional rights. And it's been a talking point because people are saying that they are disrespecting the flag. It's also been brought up that initially Colin Kaepernick just chose to sit down, but he had talked to a former veteran who was an athlete. So in order to kind of, you know, both not dishonor, our military, but also maintain his protest, he's taken a knee. We've had other players take a knee. The Seattle Seahawks took a knee, and I know this because they play the Tennessee Titans. They've taken a knee. I believe the singer of the National Anthem at the time took a knee. There have been other athletes. I know one in soccer, a couple in basketball have taken knees. And there's been a lot of discussion about this, which might make for a future episode. I'm just kind of really upset because, obviously, this has been another instance of white people hating on black people. Because I find this to be a very, not so much a non-issue, but a very, something where you can see where people are coming from. I understand that at first, you know, when you first hear it, you know, they're kneeling at the sign of the flag. They're not saluting the flag. That seems disrespectful. But when you understand the reasons why they're doing it, that should be sort of the end of the conversation. And it makes me angry that people are essentially saying that, you know, protesting the deaths of black people at the hands of the disproportionate deaths of black people at the hands of police, you know, when they're unarmed, situations like Philando Castile and various others. Like, this is a serious thing that's going on, and I feel that people who are just ginning up energy and excitement over hating these athletes. It's like there's no real way to kind of talk your way out of that. It's like, yes, there's honoring the flag, but there's also honoring the flag by way of protesting what's going on and what America represents. I've been on my feelings about that, and it's probably something that's not going to go away for a while until there should be. I don't know when it's going to go away, but Harry, what are you thinking about this?
I mean, it's weird. It's one of those issues that's really ballooned to the point where, as you say, I mean, it's reached so many people, even like singers on stage, they've taken a knee. And it's to the point where I feel like I've heard like every single angle and possible take on the matter. Excuse me. And it's like, I had something and I totally forgot. But shit.
I mean, it's one of those things where, and I was talking about you. You and I were talking about this before. I mean, I'm reminded of Muhammad Ali, him protesting the Vietnam War and basically going off to fight the Vietnam War for his religious beliefs and his American right to do so. And you know, he was suspended from boxing for 3 years. He was called a traitor and a communist and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, it brings to mind that some people see being a patriot and being a true American as a blind allegiance to the country, when our American history kind of defies that. At our heretofore most proudest moments, and there's a great hypocrisy in people saying you're dishonoring America when people are kind of, you know, holding America to a certain standard. And the cognitive dissonance in that is so apparent and stark that it's another instance of, like, you know, there are times where I really feel people are stupid. And I know that, like, that's not the right way to go about it. There must be understanding and communication and education on all sides. But, you know, I kind of just want to express myself that really there is no better patriotism than challenging America and holding it to the standard of its American dream. And how is doing that anti-American? And obviously that's sort of, you know, a non-issue, because it's not a legitimate question. So that's the kind of the crux of my feelings about it.
I mean, the outrage is, like, it's been so thoroughly deconstructed that it's hard to argue that it's not about racism at this point. Like, oh, it's about disrespect. It's about America. Well,
yeah, Paul wrote all that.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was something, some tweet where it's like laying out, like, what is illegal to do with the flag. And it's like commodify it and, like, do certain things, and it showed how, like, you know, Bud Light would commodify the flag in a certain way that's against honoring the flag or whatever, and how this is, you know, like, we've never really respected the flag in the legal manner, and so it's like suddenly this is an issue because of this racial issue, and it's obvious that it's just about anxiety, and I don't even know, like, fear about, like, I don't know. It's hard because this is, again, going into the motivations of people who we try not to think about, but have to now.
Yeah. I mean, I know how much of a jerk I just sounded, but we don't want to, like, just say this is how these people are, this is how they think, this is how they really are deep down inside, because that's just it's not a good look. But
it's hard though.
But it's one of those things where it's like, based on this, I can ascertain that people feel that it's another instance of identity. Like, you know, if you're disrespecting the flag, you're disrespecting my identity because I respect the flag in this way, and not aligning with how you're choosing to protest. It's sort of like, you know, an attack on me and our troops and, you know, what this country stands for. And it's like, okay, seriously, yeah, I know most people have taken a history class, whether they paid attention to it or not. So
It's just so frustrating. I mean, I think hypocrisy was really the key word with this one. It's just like, man, people not having a lot of perspective. I mean, America was born by disrespecting a flag, and, like, this is how change happens. And I mean, nobody really cares about the "you don't want to be on the wrong side of history" argument anymore, but it's just like, man, like, you guys are your ancestors, so that should be as obvious to you as it is to us, or, you know, should be as obvious to us as it is to you, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I think hypocrisy is sort of a thing. It's like when you lay out the basic the basic elements of it, and especially when, like, I think I mentioned this before, but, like, you know, people are kind of saying, like who is how incompetent to do this or whatever. I mean, this is a football player. This is a young guy. I think he's like 29 or something, who is very, very involved in his community. He donates a lot of money to various charities and stuff. I mean, this is not somebody who just chose to start a trend. I mean, this is a very socially conscious person doing a very progressive thing in terms of raising awareness in terms of what's going on in our country. What's been going on in our country for like half a decade at this point in terms of how it's been prolific in the news. So, and it's just one of those things where it's like, it's racial, it's societal, it's, I mean, the politics of it is sort of wrapped up in those sort of subsections. So, I don't find it to be very complicated. It's very emotionally it's a very emotionally charged talking point, but I find it to be kind of a short argument, and one that doesn't really involve a lot of soul searching on the part of the protesters. But you know, right. I'm a hippie, you know, SJW liberal, you know, SOB anyway. So I'm not being very articulate right now. I'm kind of just throwing at stones, but we probably will come back to this at a later date.
Yeah. I mean, it's also an issue that involves a lot of experts on protests and how you're supposed to do it. But so far, I mean, I feel like we've only really heard how you're not supposed to do it, as people point out. So I just, like, for anybody listening, for the thousands of people listening who disagree with Kaepernick and his ilk, I want you to, like, pitch me ideas of how somebody actually does protest something. Because I don't know anymore. Like, we're running out of options here. So I'd like to know that. And the other thing too is that, yeah, as you mentioned, like, you know, he's a football player and he's like practically a celebrity, or like he drives a high salary. And so that, like, I hate the idea that, like, that disqualifies him from having a voice. And it's the same thing with, like, LeBron James and
Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Same thing. I just, like, that's so, like,
that's so like shallow.
It is really shallow. Yeah. And I guess more so for, I guess, the professional athletes who tend to be black in this case also. It's just like, we gave this to them. It's like, you didn't do shit. You don't fund these people just by, like, having the NFL on your TV station. It's just like, I don't know. I mean, technically you do, I guess, but it's like, they don't owe you anything. And you don't have a say in what they get to do. That's fucking ridiculous. Oh my God. It's just, yeah. The idea that anybody also can be disqualified from being American too is just like, who granted you that power? Man, it's just, yeah. On all angles, it's just, like, so frustrating.
Yeah. This has been a hell of a year.
Yeah, I know.
For everybody. So I'm not saying that's going to be somewhere in the next episode, as we never know what that's going to be until the last second, but I would not be surprised if this would be, you know, coming up as a talking point very soon. It depends on how the future holds out. So let's switch gears.
Well, I mean, I suppose that my feelings about the superhero have probably changed really, really drastically over the past sort of 30 years. I mean, initially when I was 7, I saw the superheroes as an incredible source of ideas and imagination. It wasn't that I wanted to be Superman and be able to beat up bullies. I was a pretty big kid, I could beat up bullies by myself. So it was just purely the imagination that they represented. And that was how I used to feel about them. That was the way that I tried to treat them. When I began working in the genre, I tried to think of new ways to use the characters, stuff like that. My feelings have changed since. I have become really, really cranky and embittered. And it's my current feelings about the superhero are that what they largely represent. This is after looking at a lot of the people working in the superhero field and realizing that they've never formed a union, with the exception of 3 or 4 people. They have never answered back to their employers. They have never complained about the subhuman way in which they are treated. When the artists that they profess to admire are taken out and put to the wall, people like Jack Kirby, when he had had his artwork physically stolen from the Marvel Comics offices, just before they were going to have to legally give it back to him. Yeah, you know, these things happen. Just a pure coincidence, I'm sure. Nobody said a word. And you start to see a bit of a gap, a credibility gap, developing between these costumed champions who always stand up for the oppressed, who always struggle against tyrants, who are always on the side of the underdog. Yeah, and then you've got the artists who draw them, who have never shown any courage at all. And you start to think, I'm not asking these people to defend the Earth against Galactus, should he turn up. I'm just asking them to stand up for their own wives and children. You know, you start to see the American superhero as a cowardice compensator. As people who will put up with their governments and their bosses doing almost anything to them, as long as they can escape into a fantasy where they are the Hulk or the Silver Surfer and nobody pushes them around. That is the negative side of the superhero, in that it becomes something which stands for its exact opposite. And that's a bit of a downer, isn't it? I wish I hadn't actually mentioned that now. But it's the way that I've ended up feeling about the superhero. That's not to say that at some point in the future I might not dabble in the genre again, if I can find some way of doing so in a way that entertains and interests me. But really, it's the last thing that I'm thinking about at the moment. There is such a lot of wonderful material that does not involve people with their underpants outside their trousers. You know, there is a much wider universe out there, which I'm happy to explore.
As you know, I'm quite keen on comic books, especially ones about superheroes. And a popular tenet of its modern history is that while most people kind of consider superheroes comic books characters, you know, in the Super Friends / 60s Batman / you know, four color kind of news strip characters in that kind of vein, there was a real comic books, especially superhero comics, have always been sort of evolutionary. You know, they started out very pulpy, and they started out very, I don't want to say very political, but they started out, you know, fairly political and fairly straightforwardly political. A lot of the 40s comics were very explicitly pro World War II, as everyone was in America. Like, but like to the point where, like, you know, soldiers in World War II would take copies of Sergeant Rock. Actually, it was in the 40s, but Captain Marvel, Superman, Captain America, the Human Torch, Namor the Submariner, like characters who were explicitly anti-Axis and you know, into the battleground, and other characters like Batman or such per se, buy war bonds, that kind of thing. In the 50s, there was a Senate hearing saying that comic books were contributing to juvenile delinquency. There was a production of the book Seduction of the Innocent by noted psychologist Frederick Wortham, where he spat truth bombs about Superman and Wonder Woman and completely lied about Batman and Robin. That's a great conversation in itself. And so the comic sort of authority kind of sanitized comic, we talked about this before, sanitized comic books, where they basically kind of turned into a gigantic sci-fi comedy tour, especially with Batman and Superman. And in the 60s, you had the advent of the Justice League of America and Marvel Comics. Marvel Comics, which ended up being a lot more subversive, thanks to very talented artists Steve Ditko, Jack Kirby, and famous shyster Stan Lee. In the 70s, you would have sort of the drug culture and a lot of social relevance kind of hitting comic books hard with Green Lantern and Green Arrow, Doctor Strange, Captain Marvel, kind of being kind of subversive in the way where, like, there's a lot of, like, kind of counterculture. There were subjects about race being explicitly brought about in comic books in ways in which the very white medium had not seen yet before. Which brings us to the 80s, where was often titled the British Invasion. You have writers such as Peter Milligan and Neil Gaiman, Paul Jenkins, Grant Morrison, and most successfully and famously, Alan Moore, coming to characters and coming to books and mainstream companies with a very strong sense of storytelling. They kind of flipped the script on some characters like Swamp Thing, Superman and Batman. They would kind of bring forth popular comics that started out in the UK, like Miracle Man and V for Vendetta. And the decade in the late 80s sort of ended with books like Watchmen, The Killing Joke, and showed the medium, the kind of potential it had to kind of tell very adult, very mature storytelling, or types of storytelling. And Alan Moore is probably going to be like the main writer we'll be mentioning, because his Watchmen work and to a lesser extent his Killing Joke work helped pave the way for the Dark Age of comics, which he famously decries, because that led to Image, where a comic company that was very much artist-led, and you have characters like Spawn, Savage Dragon, Gen 13, and the Wildstorm heroes, be a lot more kind of violent and kind of crazy without the philosophical and literary underpinnings, and kind of being not as good as Watchmen, kind of going for that sort of mature audience. And this sort of, you know, kind of transformed the comics industry. Marvel was very much chasing Image, very much trying to kind of chase those mature storytellings. You'd have storylines like The Death of Superman and Nightfall kind of take the hero, kind of take them out and subvert them, kind of subvert what they were meant to be. And storytelling was very much not made for kids anymore. Superhero combos were not made for kids. It was a lot more violent, a lot more sexualized, to the point where, in sort of a development that started, I would say, in the 70s, in earnest, and kind of continued and evolved to now, it is modern understanding that comic books really aren't made for kids anymore, at least in terms of the main superhero books. Like, if you watched a Wonder Woman film and went to see a modern Wonder Woman comic, it really wouldn't be made for a 10-year-old. If you watched the Avengers movie in 2012 and went down to watch Brian Michael Bendis' New Avengers or the Avengers book, it really wouldn't be made for them. Not in terms of content and tone, but just kind of in terms of continuity. The continuity of Marvel Comics and the continuity of DC Comics are very much seen as impenetrable. And a lot of the modern superhero movie adaptations kind of capture that sense of not impenetrability, but, you know, modern storytelling. They're not really made in the 60s Batman, 70s Superman-esque aesthetic, where it's a lot more modern, it's a lot more quote-unquote realistic, or at least believable. And Alan Moore has famously decried this sort of approach to superheroes more than once. I mean, he's written other books. You know, he's done Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is nothing like the film adaptation. He's done books like From Hell, Top 10, Tom Strong, which aren't superhero comics, they're just kind of comic books. And he was quoted in 2013, and I know that's not this first quote, but it's sort of a kind of a lightning rod of response, where he said, quote, "I haven't read any superhero comics since I finished with Watchmen." I probably should be doing his accent, but I don't think I will. I hate superheroes. I think they're abominations. Have you heard him talk before?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, he even did a voice on The Simpsons one time.
Oh yeah.
Alan Moore, you wrote my favorite issues of Radioactive Man.
Oh, really? So you like that I made your favorite superhero a heroin-addicted jazz critic who's not radioactive?
I don't read the words. I just like when he punches people. How do you make his costume stick so close to his muscles?
I hate superheroes. I think they're abominations. They don't mean what they used to mean. They were originally in the hands of writers who would actively expand the imagination of their 9 to 13-year-old audience. That was completely what they were meant to do, and they were doing it excellently. These days, superhero comics think the audience is certainly not 9 to 13. It's nothing to do with them. It's an audience largely of 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old men, usually men. Someone came up with the term graphic novel. These readers latched onto it. They were simply interested in a way that could validate their continued love of Green Lantern or Spider-Man without appearing in some way emotionally subnormal. This is a significant rump of the superhero-addicted, mainstream-addicted audience. I don't think the superhero stands for anything good. I think it's a rather alarming sign if we got audiences of adults going to see the Avengers movie and delighting in concepts and characters meant to entertain the 12-year-old boys of the 1950s. Now, in response to that quote, there's been a lot of like comic book fans on podcasts and message boards and everything like that, just saying screw Alan Moore. Who was he to say this? He's the one that wrote Killing Joke. He's the one that wrote Watchmen. I mean, he's wrote some of the most adult comic books there have ever been. Who is he to say this? Who is he to kind of, you know, talk down to us? He doesn't even keep up with comic books anymore. Fuck Alan Moore. I'm not necessarily of that belief. We'll get into it, but like I do think it's a talking point that he's raised that's worth discussing. But that is sort of the tension, you know. Is Alan Moore just a curmudgeon? It's not about Alan Moore specifically, but is he a rambling old curmudgeon who worships snakes and basically is a wizard for hire? And he is. Or does he have a point and have comic book fans basically, you know, kind of grown up into, like, you know, middle-aged madmen? You know, is it insane that we're reading Secret Empire and watching Captain America fight a Nazi version of himself? Is it madness that we're watching, you know, like The Dark Knight, and, you know, we're seeing Two-Face be created in explicit detail? Like, is have we gone mad that, like, you know, our comic book films are as believable as they have been actually talking about certain things, you know, adopting certain comic books adopting certain mature themes that are nowhere meant for kids? Like, is that a sign of an industry that's kind of run away with itself and kind of, you know, on a downward spiral towards, you know, as he says, subnormal emotional states? So I'm the comics guy generally on this podcast. Harry is generally the sci-fi guy, although you've definitely read comic books, and we've talked about comic books before. We've talked about Superior Comics on your own show, Battle Beyond Planet X, and we've talked about the notion of what would happen if comics or superheroes were real. And it's a very different conversation than, you know, kind of just enjoying them in their sort of four-color world. But I'm very interested to hear what you think. What do you think about the notion that maybe the concept is kind of twisted itself into a bizarro, if you will, alternate version of what it meant to be? Or is this sort of a conversation that's kind of a moot because they are successful targeting themselves to older audiences? What's your opinion on the Moore's statement and the topic at hand?
I mean, I think that if he didn't keep bringing this up, then comic book fans might have, you know, pulled on their collar a little bit at the arrival of Dawn of Superman Part versus Justice.
Yeah, that piece
whatever
of
that movie is called.
Right.
But I mean, no, like, that's just an example of like darkness done bad, and you can do darkness well. Obviously, we saw with Batman Begins, or even, you know, 1989 Tim Burton's Batman, but. You know, I think that one of the first arguments against Alan Moore was even cited in, not this article, but another one, which is that, you know, superheroes are not just a kind of replication of mythology, but they are mythology in a sense. And one of the characteristics there is that we keep trying to reinvent and update. And even though that's taken on a recent inflection of social justice, it's superheroes are no different than Star Wars or something like that. And obviously that sounds so stupid now because all the big movies are either Marvel or Star Wars these days. But yeah, I mean, that's like, he's not talking about comic books being just for children, like funny book style. Although he does come out against the term graphic novel, which honestly I kind of find some utility in, just because like, Aline Brosh McKenna, who's a writer on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, just came out with a book called Jane, which is kind of a comic version of Jane Eyre. And I understand like why she would gravitate to that term, because it's its own thing. It's so sophisticated. Well, no, I mean, just like the nature of what it is. It's not really connected to anything else. It's a standalone thing. But again, like...
I gotcha, it's useful.
But, I mean, comic books are, you know, like as Scott McCloud points out, they're a very human impulse, in the same way that like we drew cave paintings and that hieroglyphs, like sequential art is just another mode of storytelling that is very natural. And so that's a medium. And then when you kind of accept that the way that, for example, the Europeans or the Japanese do, then it just becomes normal. Superheroes is I think the same thing, but just a little bit, not quite as they are a medium more so than a genre, I would say. Because you can just do so much. But I think Moore's problem, honestly, if I could psychoanalyze him, is that I think he kind of saw himself in the context of a genre. And when that context didn't kind of meet his expectation of it, he got upset because he was trying to show you what you could do in the genre, of course, while also kind of criticizing it. But he was criticizing a very specific thing, and then it just became something else that he didn't predict. And so I get it. I can kind of see both sides, but at the same time, like, I don't get emotionally reactive to Alan Moore in this case. And I don't honestly, like, I kind of see how comic book fans do, but I also kind of, on the other hand, I'm like, there are so many, like, milkshake ducks in comic books that it's like, how could this guy compare to, like, Frank Miller or anybody? Like, but, I mean, even in the broader sense, like, I mean, I just read something about Harry Knowles, and we always knew that that guy was kind of off, but if you even care to pay attention to him, as I did not. And it's just, like guys are becoming shitty everywhere, and usually it's about, like, criminal behavior, usually against women. And Alan Moore, like, I don't think he understands necessarily that, like, you have to consider certain reactions when you're writing about sexual assault in Saga of the Swamp Thing and all these different things. But,
right.
I don't think he's, like, a bad guy on that level.
No.
Honestly, the person who I think he reminds me the most of is Hideaki Anno, who would always come out against otakus. And, you know, Evangelion is basically this huge middle finger to otakus, and it's not like they didn't notice. But I guess it's just because Hideaki Anno comes off a little bit more tortured than Alan Moore that it's harder to be mad at him. But, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, at some point, metatext is kind of violent in a sense towards, you know, the text. That's a stupid thing to say. That's like freshman year college literary bullshit. I guess I can see all sides. So from my centrist point of view, bouncing it back, how do you react to the Moore man?
Well, I like Alan Moore. I said this before we started recording that, like, reminded you that when I was in high school, I did a paper on him, and that was after I'd read Watchmen, and I think it was also the same year. It was around 2005 or 2006 that DC had a collection, like the DC Comics of Alan Moore, because he would do, like, you know, guest spots on, I said, Superman. Like, The Killing Joke is not his only Batman story. He wrote a Batman story with Clayface, which is pretty interesting. He, of course, Swamp Thing, obviously. He wrote a very, a pretty notable Green Lantern story. He did a great two-part story in Vigilante, which I had mentioned. I've mentioned that comic before. I'd never read Vigilante before back then, but, like, it was, like, one of some of the best comic work I've ever seen, where Vigilante, the character Vigilante, who is a Vigilante, he goes after a guy who kidnaps his daughter, and you kind of see, like, the guy's perspective, but it's also very, very compromising. It's very good, and of course the collection ended with The Killing Joke, which I've talked about not on this podcast. I recommend the Batgirl Oracle special where we talk about that story.
Yes,
because I feel that, like, we give that story as much talking as we can, you know, its pros and cons, because I don't think it's either all good or all bad, but it's definitely worth discussing its pros and cons. I've read League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It fucked me up when I was 16, because there's some horrible things that happened in that story. I was afraid I was going to have nightmares reading that.
Man.
But I think Alan Moore is a terrific, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, oh, Watchmen's overrated. Like you're an idiot if you think that. Like, I reread it last year for a comic film review, and it's even better than I thought it. I thought I understood it was, but I remember, like, the first I heard about this was, like, I was listening to a podcast years ago. This is back, I think, before I was even in the podcast game myself. But I was listening to a podcast, I think it was before this specific quote, because this quote's in 2013. I think it was around 2011 where he was quoted saying this, maybe in reaction to the Watchmen film, and. I remember people saying, you know, like Alan Moore should shut up because he wrote this story and this story, and those stories were just as dark. They literally said he should shut up, and it's like, they just sounded like so. I mean, these were my friends. These are people that I'm still friends with, but they sounded just so like adverse to any ponderings of what he was saying. Just kind of, you know, adverse. So kind of elitist too, like kind of adverse to criticism and, like, not really thinking about the potential of what he might be saying. Now, I don't, you know, obviously I'm a guy who just wrote God knows how many words about the third Robin in the 1990s. I spent hours doing that. Like, obviously I find merit in wasting my time reading about Batman. But I do think there is a discussion here where, you know, Jewish teenagers create Batman, Jewish teenagers create Superman, and they just happen to last decades. I think that there is, you know, that they were made for kids. They, you know, they were sold for like 10 cents to children on newsstands. I think there is some merit to say, you know, how have they changed from 80 years ago till now, and how, in what ways has that not been for the better? I think that's a conversation to have. And it's not, and like, let's not get it twisted. It's not as though Alan Moore has thoroughly despised, you know, he's not a pretentious, I mean, he may be pretentious, but like, he's not a guy who's like, just says, oh, I've never liked superheroes, because he, the Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, which is like the last Superman story before they rebooted him in the late 80s, he basically like all but threatened the editor to write that story because he's a gigantic Superman fan. I mean, whatever you think about his Superman work, he writes Superman out of a labor of love. Superman has been his favorite comic book hero. For people who don't like The Killing Joke, I mean, he's in agreement. He's surprised that he got away with what he did. He finds kind of what he did to certain characters very repellent. It's actually kind of the fault of like the late Alan Len Wein, who we just lost a couple of weeks ago, and how callous he was towards certain characters. But and I'm not trying to, like, you know, kind of be an arbiter for Alan Moore's rantings. I mean, he can be kind of dickish. I think he's definitely not being very ingratiating towards the conversation. But I do think it's a conversation. I do think that, like, people who just write him off as a crank who can never be satisfied are kind of just really kind of taking sides, I feel, because they enjoy the Watchmen film and they enjoy the Before Watchmen miniseries and they enjoy the fact that the Watchmen are being brought into the, you know, in this massive DC Comics crossover, which, I mean, that's some of the worst, like, selling out things that DC's ever done. I mean, I think that there is, like, I don't necessarily believe that there's always two sides to every story, but I think in this instance, it's a conversation which I find very hard to just straight up ignore and just say, well, fuck him because he insulted me and my comic books. I mean, you know, I mean, I feel that I'm fairly aware of the innate, innate observation that these are characters with a very limited scope of storytelling. Not in terms of, you know, they can't tell any story, but the stories that they should be telling aren't always for every audience. It's like, and I think that, like, should superheroes only be made for kids? I think that is very limiting. I think because some of the best, the reason why I'm so into these characters is because I feel that, like, I was made witness to stories that weren't necessarily for little kids, but I liked them anyway. You know, I think kids always grab onto things that are kind of geared towards a demographic that's older than them, and I feel that that can help them in their education, help them in storytelling potential. But obviously, you know, you should not be giving a 10-year-old Lee of Extraordinary Gentlemen at all.
As you had.
Well, I mean, that wasn't anybody's fault. I found that in the bookstore. I was like, ooh! And like, ooh. Oh my god, what is Hyde doing to the Invisible Man? I can't sleep. Yeah. But, you know, yes, you know, Moore isn't exactly throwing himself. I mean, he has put himself in terms of blame in the past. It's not this quote, but like, he has said, I have contributed to the Dark Age of comics. And maybe he's not done it to the extent where people would be satisfied. But listen to what he's really trying to say. You know, yes, you know, he should be saying, well, he should be blaming The Killing Joke and, you know, Arkham Asylum, whatever. Like, but like, genuinely, like the topic at hand, like, what is he trying to say? Has comic books being geared to only towards adults given a shit like Dawn of Justice? I mean, that is pretty much the number one A-grade example of how you don't do this sort of thing. Whereas, and, you know, whether you like The Dark Knight or dislike it, it very much changed how people viewed the potential of superhero stories that had not, you know, necessarily read the comic books. There are some terrific stories that are very adult that I think if one should do a comic book storytelling class, could be told in comics. Besides Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns, you could do like Daredevil Born Again. You could do the Green Lantern, Green Arrow comic. As dated as they are, you could still do them. You could do some of the Ditko Spider-Mans. I mean, like, you know, there is adult merit in... I'm talking a long time. I'm going to wrap up. There is adult merit in reading superhero comics beyond just giving them for kids. But at the same time, does that... what's lost rescinding them from the eyes of children, where basically, like, the industry itself is not made for kids, There is a death of something there. I remember being in my comic shop, and a guy was looking. Like a girl said, "Oh, I want this dad." And she looked at this this Batgirl comic, and I'd read that. I reviewed that for the Batman Universe, and I knew damn well that was not meant for her. It's very violent. It was just kind of grimy and shittily written, and just I said that's not you're not going to want her to read that. Trust me on it. So that's kind of the tragedy that I think he speaks to. Like, why can't kids read a Batgirl comic? The late Darwin Cook said there should never be a story. There should never ever be a Superman story that's not meant for kids. That should just never happen. And I think there's something to that. So I think that there is a push and pull of a conversation here that you and I should have. If comic book podcasters aren't willing to have that,
we do what the others can't.
Hell yeah.
I mean, I think there's also an element of defining what mature storytelling is. And when you said that Image was kind of a reaction to Alan Moore, or at least the Dark Age, I was like, oh, wow. Like, that makes a lot of sense. And knowing Image, like, without having really read any Image, I don't think, it's just like, gosh, like that, it is all the blood and gore and nudity with none of the anything else. And, you know, Watchmen is like, it's too much. Like, the fact that it was made even more violent in the movie is just absurd, because it's like the comedian shoots a pregnant woman in Vietnam. It's just like, was that really necessary to get the point across? Right. It's like, it's grotesque, and I think it's a little bit too much. But, you know, I think that, you know, we talked about things like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Steven Universe before in this podcast, and I think what Steven Universe in particular shows us is that mature storytelling has nothing to do with content rating, even though Steven Universe is TV PG, which is essentially the equivalent of the PG-13 in movies.
Yeah, which is weird.
I know, it's a little weird, but most we decided it was because of the gay stuff.
The gay stuff, yes.
The gay stuff. But I mean, like when, I mean, with the Batgirl anecdote, it's like, I would, like, the reason I think that the recommendation against her reading that book should be more about, because it's shittily written, more than content, because and maybe this is just the way I came up, but my parents were very strict about movies and video games. Like, I could not buy M-rated games until I was like 17, and I could not go to see R-rated movies alone. Well, I mean, that's the law, I guess. The law! But
you didn't break it like I did?
I did not. I don't think I ever did.
I snuck into V for Vendetta.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. Talk about a movie to watch when you're young.
Yeah, no, nothing happened.
That's good. But, I mean, like, for books, like, it was never really a factor. And maybe they just never really paid attention to what I was reading, which wasn't much anyway. I mean, because I remember being young, and I think my parents' only concern was that I just wouldn't understand it, which was very true, because I remember seeing, like, the Sum of All Fears novel or novelization in a liquor store, like, when I was, like, 7 or whenever. I guess that would have been 2002, so I would have been 9. And I was like, I really want to read this. It must have been, like, the first book I had ever seen while I was, like, online or conscious or something. And my dad was like, well, it's really big, and I think that's why I wanted to read it, because it was really big. And I wanted to look smart more than be smart.
We're still doing that.
Yeah, I know. It continues to the day. But and it was true. Like, I think I just read or finished, like, physically turning all the pages of Jurassic Park, not necessarily absorbing any of it, but I thought that I was invincible. But, you know, I started reading, like, the Aliens versus Predator novelizations of the comic books in the 6th grade, and I was, like, really blown away by how mature that book seemed at the time, because it involved lesbians, more gay stuff, and also, like, incredible descriptions of violence. And I think that my parents are just like, if it's on the page, like, it doesn't really matter. And I guess that also extended to comic books too, even though they were illustrations. But it's just, I think that it never really had that same effect. Plus, there's no real rating system for comic books that I'm aware of. I don't know if it's even just a binary, like in music.
There was eventually, because obviously there was a Comics of Authority, and then, like, around the 70s, like they started, there were instances of comics breaking that, like, you know, I may have mentioned before, but, like, you know, you couldn't do drugs in comics, and then, like, Stan Lee had that governor commissioned drug story of Spider-Man, so they just ran without it. So, like, comic books that like were basically not for kids, they just didn't have the Comics Code Authority, like some Daredevil stuff. And I know eventually Marvel Comics had its own rating system. I remember, like, the early 2000s, like, you know, it was like, I think it was like 10, 16, M or A. You know, I don't actually know what it was, but I know that they had its own rating system. And then, as of now, recently the Archie Comics line have just abandoned the Comics Code Authority. So the Comics Code Authority is like non-existent anymore.
Wow, that's probably for the better. I mean, like, I think for pros, like, obvious, like, absolutely anything is on the table for anybody at any age, so long as they can understand it. Unless it's something like, I don't know, Mein Kampf or something. I mean, and even those debates are still debates worth having, I suppose. But in terms of just like, oh, I don't want my kid reading Stephen King because he might get nightmares. Like, you don't know that. It might inspire his or her imagination. And so I think that, like, books are always going to be a safe space. And movies are not. Like, movies contain specific imagery that is meant to simulate real life. And so that can be potentially traumatic to a child. I understand that. Comics are kind of in the middle, you know, as the storyboards that Hollywood believes they are. It's a little bit more ambiguous because you have, you know, illustrations. It's not just in the imagination. So I still want to lean towards comics are always going to be safe. Maybe even if kids can't understand what's actually happening. But I don't think that, like, if somebody who is like 7, which is, you know, pretty old for like a kid, or like, you know, 5 or whatever, like, reads Watchmen, that they're going to be like super messed up. And maybe they don't understand it, but there's still value there. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm coming at this issue from a weird obverse angle, where it's like, that the issue is, the industries are moving away from telling stories for children, but I think that it's all marketing. It's all what they want to label. I mean, it's the same in Japan, how they have labels like seinen and shonen for like girls and boys and older people. It's like, I don't want that. And I don't want people to commodify darkness either, which is what they're doing. I mean, The Dark Knight is still kind of the pinnacle of mature storytelling. It's not as violent as BVS. It's not as violent as Logan, but it still hasn't been matched. Like, Logan came close, but it's still not The Dark Knight. And the reason why is because it's arguable, but it's more ambitious. And that's not to say that we can measure comic book movies quantitatively either, but you know, it's just, it didn't have to be super violent to be mature, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
There's no blood in it at all.
Yeah.
Because a man gets burned alive.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
So your first point, I think that, like, I've agreed, I totally agree that, like, books don't have rating systems. And it's interesting to me because I guess people just imagine, well, if you're imagining the violence and the gore, all this kind of stuff, that's not as bad as when you're seeing it, when it's presented to you. Which is interesting, because everyone always says, oh, this is not as bad as what I imagined. You know, horror is much more stronger when you're imagining in your head, you know? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
When you're not seeing, when someone's reacting to something that they see, but you don't see what they're seeing, you have imagined something so horrible. That's effective. But there's always also the image. But yeah, I remember when I was a little kid, I was like, you know, I liked Robotech, and I read the Jack McKinney Robotech novels, which were written just a little bit, I mean, just not to a great degree, but they were a little more mature. There was more swearing, I believe, in it. But I would be at the, you know, at like, we would be out at restaurants, I'd be like reading that, and I'd be like 8 or 9 years old. But also, at the same time, I don't know if my parents, I'm pretty sure my parents really did not, I didn't have a lot of mature comics in my room, but my uncle did have a Frank Miller collection of Batman that had Batman Year One and The Dark Knight Returns. That my dad read to me.
Yeah.
And I was in first grade, and I don't know if my dad really reconciled how messed up it was. He did see, like, I remember him seeing the animated adaptations of both. They came on, like, cable or whatever, and he came to me, like within this year, said, you know, this is so dark, and it's like Batman's like snapping the Joker's neck, all this kind of stuff, and I'm like, yeah, we had that comic book upstairs, man. Like, you read that to me 20 years ago. So I don't know what he was thinking. Because even when I was a kid, especially with Dark Knight Returns, that's an R-rated comic. Because, like, the language is much harsher. The violence is way harsher. I don't think Batman's ever been as messed up as he has been in that comic book. So, like, I feel that, like, there is a definite, like, you know, I don't know if I would advertise that to little kids to read, But sure. I do think that, like, you know, if you're like, I think if you're a 10-year-old, you can kind of take it. I mean, hell, I actually read Dark Knight Returns, like the story, the chapter where he's getting beat up by the mutant leader. I remember reading that in church.
Oh my God, you bad kid!
And now look at me, this brain in the face with a crowbar. But
oh my gosh,
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. I don't know if anybody because this goes back to the kind of the scare and the like the scapegoat of comic books leading to child delinquency in the '50s. You know, they would see comics of Superman. You know, like doing all these kind of fascist things, which he did because he was this big like socialist, you know, wet dream. And say, you know, oh, children are going to grow up and you're thinking they could just act like Superman, kind of just throwing things around, just chucking cars into buildings and all that kind of stuff.
Yep, jumping off buildings, yep.
Yeah, which is nuts. I mean, if you read any of those comic books, you know, the EC stuff was, you know, horror comic books and, you know, like women's heads getting chopped off. That kind of stuff is kind of crazy. But that's very much in terms of, you know, like the pulp books. The books about, you know, child delinquency and teenage delinquency and, you know, kids, you know, being prostitutes and taking drugs and all that kind of stuff. That was stuff that I remember, I guess, I don't know if they were involved in, like, the book-burning stuff or whatever, but, you know, stuff like Fahrenheit 451 or whatever. They're kind of done in that vein. But comic books were always sort of this, like I said, the scapegoat. They were always very much sort of this excuse to kind of, you know, this is very, you know, banal, unintelligent, kind of moronic entertainment. They only got sillier after the Comics Code came in. Like there's a great essay that talks about how Batman and Robin like, really were not... like as gay as the people thought when Frederick Wortham got a hold of them, but like once the editors introduced Batwoman and Batgirl to make them less gay, they got even more gay because they were like, you know, we don't want to hang out with them; they're girls.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. And then of course, the '60s Batman show. Which how much of the '60s Batman show have you actually seen?
I mean, I've only seen like clips that Malcolm in the Middle's opening title would use in essence. I don't think they actually used any, but that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. It's great. Because the thing about that is that I've said that like when you're a kid you love the '60s Batman show. When you're older you hate it, and then when you're the right age you learn to love it again.
Yeah.
Because you know kids liked being entertained by it. Adults liked it because it was very much an intentional comedy. It was lampooning. It was actually meant to lampoon. The serials, like the original 40 serials, which I like because they kind of played straight, and even though they are like horrendously racist, they were trying to do the comics straight as they were in the Golden Age. In fact, the '60s show was made because the serials were being shown at the Playboy Mansion by Hugh Hefner, who loved them.
Wow.
Ironically enough,
yeah.
We just lost yesterday. If we're gonna give a moment of that, but. The '60s show is very, like, I won't say subversive, but it's camp in the real sense of camp. I mean, it's not campy as in silly. It's campy as in that kind of, like, that aesthetic. That very kind of, you know, kind of, like sexually aware, kind of like, you know, very intentional tongue-in-cheek. Like, Batman and Robin are dorks, and they're meant to be dorks. And the joke is that they're seen as, like, you know, the epitome of what people should be. Like, Batman's like, you know, Robin, you're a growing boy. You should drink your milk. Gosh, you're right, Batman. Like... the comics never were like that.
Right.
But it was seen as, like, you know, a gigantic parody, and they played it, and Adam West played it so straight. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where the humor was. And the villains would be just insane, and, like, that's why celebrities always want to be on the show, because it was seen as the height of, it was like the height of culture, because it was so subversive, and, you know, kids loved it, and adults loved it, but because it didn't take itself seriously, that was sort of seen as, you know, kind of doing comics in that kind of way. But at the same time, you know, when it fell out of favor, it was only seen as, you know, it only could be silly. It couldn't really be mature. So, you know, you have in the '70s where Denny O'Neill took Batman back to his detective roots and, you know, made the Joker scary again and, you know, brought back Two-Face because he was, you know, kind of X'd out after a while and, you know, had him fight mad scientists and Ra's al Ghul was created. All the kind of, like, you know, more... This stuff that was kind of taken more seriously. Like Batman kind of went through his Bond phase... And Bond was kind of seen, you know, as a, sort of a genuine thing in the Sean Connery era. And you would have other, you know, the Superman film of the 1978 Superman film. There's a video essay that kind of talked about how it's very much aware of its comic book origins, and it's not shying away from it. Like there are kind of moments where people are like, "Can you believe this guy, Superman?" Like, you know, Lois Lane talks to him and Lex Luthor talks about him, but it's aware of kind of the inherent silliness of the concept, but it's not. It's also kind of embracing it in a way. Compared to the Avengers, which I like the Avengers, but I don't know how aware of itself the Avengers really is. I'm not really sure, because there is, like, you know, like, oh, we're all jerks, you know, we shouldn't team up together, but they do at the end. I'm not really sure that there's any sort of comment on a superhero team up, really at all. Not that, that there needs to be, but some of the older stuff is kind of more aware of its source material than in terms of the thematic underpinnings than other stuff. But, I mean, I think that, like, people have found ways which comic books can kind of be metatextual, kind of be subtle, and by the end of the 80s, with Watchmen and stuff, you know, no one had ever seen comic books that adult, and kind of talking about stuff like homosexuality and sex, and especially with Watchmen, what I'm always interested in is how it uses the comic book medium to really kind of tell a story. Like, comic books can't, you know, movies can't do what Watchmen does in terms of, you know, page layout and the way they kind of, you know, kind of dip in and out of the pirate comic and stuff. And that is a lot of what Moore's frustration is, because Watchmen was supposed to be an example of the potential of not only the superhero genre, but the comic book medium. You know, and then, like, you know, Image Comics came, and Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and X-Force and Cable and Deadpool, and so everything was ruined. and by 1998, Marvel went bankrupt, and and then, you know, end of the story. But, you know, I think that, like, people who like, because there are a lot of people who just don't like the smart stuff. People don't like, a lot of Superman fans just really enjoy, you know, Superman fighting giant robots and Lex Luthor. They don't like what happened to Man Tomorrow, because they find it to be cynical, which I can understand it to be. They don't like, they don't even like All-Star Superman, because they think that Grant Morrison, well, All-Star Superman is like a, Grant Morrison's one of the, it's a Scottish writer. He's a very, very hyper-intelligent guy, and it's basically Silver Age Superman kind of done modern, so there's a lot of, like, scientific talk, and they think it's pretentious, but, it's one of those things where, like, I can see people not liking comic books being unsavory and distasteful. You know, we don't need to see, you know, Batman do a tracheectomy on a little baby because the Riddler's gone nuts because of some sort of voodoo thing. Like, we don't need to see Green Lantern's girlfriend chopped up in a refrigerator for him to find and for him to be mad. You know, we don't need to see that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that like, I don't think, when comics are that nasty, it's automatically bad. You know, I guess it's sort of one of those things where it's like, you know, there's an example of abusing strong storytelling, but there's also examples of it being done effectively. Does that automatically mean that taking superheroes to dark places is good? Or is there any argument to say that superheroes should only be for kids, do you think? Like should there always be a Superman story that's only meant for kids? What do you think about that part of the argument?
I mean, I guess it just depends on how the writer or the creator thinks, or what they think it means, which is it like essentially like the breakdown between how people perceive Pixar versus DreamWorks? Like, DreamWorks was for so long just the kids' animated movies, and then Pixar is the adults get the jokes too, until, like, I guess Shrek, and then it was just over forever. Culture died.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean. I don't know. I mean, I just think that kids can enjoy anything. I guess it's like, is there a space for comic books that are designed for them? And then does that exclude anybody else? And I don't know. It's like, do you want to make Steven Universe every time, or do you want to make, like, I don't know, Danger and Eggs? That's my only other cartoon. Phineas and Ferb.
Never heard of Danger and Eggs.
Well, it's pretty bad. It's on Amazon, I think, but I have to watch it for work. But, like, okay. You know, these, like, really, you know, inane, just basically, like, flashing colors and light. And for comic books, or for superhero comics, I don't know what that would be. But, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, I think that any medium in any genre is serviced by a healthy biodiversity. But I guess the question is, does the creation of something naturally exclude a certain part of the demographic? And I mean, again, I just think it's all in how it's marketed and the commerciality factor of it. Because I mean, honestly, like, you have to be able to like what you like and kind of put everybody else's opinion aside, and I understand that that's like a lot harder than people always make it sound when they say that. I mean, my opinions, my reactions to things are undoubtedly influenced by other people's opinions, like all the time. And so that's hard. But I think that you have to kind of be able to get Alan Moore's voice out of your head, or like Roger Ebert when he's talking about how video games can't be art, like all of these old arguments about like the validity of certain things. But for this point specifically, I don't know. Like I guess because, I mean, like when I saw the footage of DC Supergirls, like that looked pretty kiddie. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many like 30-year-old women fans would perceive that, if they would feel excluded by it because their daughters were into it. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's fine. Like if you don't want to watch that, you have like literally everything else at your disposal. You can watch Birds of Prey made for the CW or
don't
something.
Watch Birds of Prey.
Do watch Birds of Prey.
Actually, the pilot was better than I remembered, but yeah,
No.
Well, speaking of 30-year-olds who watch that, Stella, like we did a commentary just for laughs on her show, and it was there's a scene where Ma Kent invites Lady Shiva over for like a sleepover, which is hilarious.
Nice.
I think there's a healthy variation. Like DC Supergirls is mad popular. We went to a panel this past Comic-Con for work, and that place was filled to the brim, and filled to the brim with a lot of little girls who were enthusiastically dressed as these characters. It was like, oh my god, this is everything we want to ensure the future and the thriving of this genre, and everything that the Gamergate just doesn't want to see. But it was great. It was wonderful. But, I mean, you brought up Steven Universe. I think that's a good point. That, like, Steven Universe is a show that, like, I totally took for granted when I heard about it. Like, when I saw that it was making, you know, news articles about it and stuff like that, I was like, oh, that's one of those, you know, modern Cartoon Network shows that doesn't mean anything. It's like, you know, Teen Titans Go, they're just, like, screaming and talking about pizza and whatever. Steven Universe, that sounds like, oh, that's really clever. And, you know, I started watching, like, 4 hours later, like, you know, Steven shoved out into space. I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, it's absolutely an example of something that's very much, it's very much targeted towards kids, but it's very much meant for everybody. You know, it's actually kind of ironic because I'm wearing a Steven Universe shirt today, and three times before I came home, people were asking, "Hey, that's a really cool shirt. I really like Steven Universe." Like that's, yeah. Like within an hour, like three people had commented to me on my shirt. Wow. They were older than I was, which is a good thing because I'm thinking about comics like beyond stuff that like is very much all ages friendly, like Ms. Marvel. I mean, Ms. Marvel deals with stuff like racism, obviously, and you know, different cultures. It's still dealing with very, very real world stuff, but it's dealing with it in a very like not. It's in a mature way, but not in a way that would just not be appropriate for younger kids. Because she's a teen character, and like it's not. It's a book that's very much made to not turn off younger audiences or older audiences seeking to bring in younger audiences. It's a very well done book. But I'm thinking about stuff like even like Cassandra Cain's Batgirl, and you know, a lot of people kind of label her as like, you know, she was the dark Batgirl. She was darker than Barbara Gordon. You know, she has this dark origin. Yeah. But like, and granted, there are scenes like, you know, like of like David King shooting her in the back when she's like eight or whatever. But even so, like the storytelling in that book is pretty, I think, it's good enough where I feel that, like, it attracts a younger audience. I mean, like, the fighting is great, the artwork is great, and the stories are never really so mature that kids can't wrap their heads around it. I mean, obviously, if someone's getting shot, are you just going to balk at that, or is this one of the things where you kind of accept an action storytelling? Mm-hmm. There's not an instance of somebody, like, you're not going to see a scene of, like, you know, from, like, Prometheus of, like, something coming out of her gut or whatever. Like, it's not like that. It's just, that's just kind of character that she is, and you know, it is still a DC comic book. It can be a strongly told comic book. I do think that's an example of one that kids and girls and whatever could read, because there's a narrative there that they can kind of engage themselves with that doesn't necessarily talk down to them, but doesn't, you know, kind of speak over their head either. And I also think that Kelly Puckett's a great writer. So I think that, like, I do think that. In the best case scenario, it should be done for all ages. Frank Miller talks about how there was a lot of like worry in the comics industry in Marvel around the 70s finding audiences that really weren't, they're like, you know, younger kids, which is why he wrote for Daredevil the way he was. I mean, apparently he had a lot of flack from editorial for making Daredevil very violent, like with characters like Bullseye and Elektra and the Kingpin. But the sales were excellent, and because he said, you know, adults read these comics, you know, it's not really, comics don't really find their ways towards kids anymore. It is the adults that buy them. It is, it's not so much that they're only making it for adults. Adults are the only ones that are kind of reading it anymore. Which is, you know, not to say that it's not the industry's fault or, you know, their marketing, like you said, the marketing. But, you know, it's one of those kind of happenstance things. Maybe they could try harder. And I think they have. There are definitely books for kids specifically, like some Archie books that are still being done. Sonic, actually, they just canceled Sonic. But there are books that are made for younger audiences, but they are very much like a tenth of the total output. But I think that like I think a larger percentage is like, you know, all ages comic books, and I think what more might what people have not brought up that I think more does underestimate is how younger kids can take to certain kinds of books. I do think that like a majority of books aren't written for them in mind. But there are some where they can read that are, you know, not beyond their that wouldn't be damaging for them to read, essentially. Or maybe it will be if they are my age and they still like this stuff. Maybe that is damaging. Like the worst case scenario of a man pushing 30 into these comic books is, I guess, you know, the hell on earth that he's warning us about.
Right, and that's really what we should be focusing on. But I mean, it is true that like. You know, kids, like, I don't know when they learn about death, but it's true that, like, they become adults, like, still we were kids once. We, you know, kids have pretty fucked up minds. Like, when they're playing G.I. Joe toys and they're shooting each other, like, what do you think they're thinking? Oh, I saw his parachute fly out of his back. They're not doing that.
Right.
They always want their media to be a little bit harder, like their older brothers and sisters enjoy. And, you know, when the Wonder Woman movie came out, like, that was, like, so important that it was an all ages movie, even though it was certified PG-13 in its country of origin, like everybody saw that movie. But yeah, so on the flip side, we have the idea that adult comic book fans are, what is, emotionally subnormal.
Right.
Which you could probably just apply across the board for all of nerds. But, and at that point, all of humanity, because we are all nerds. But yeah, I think that's kind of the next consideration. What do we have to say about that part?
Well, it's funny because I had recently come across this this indie comic series called The Eltingville Club by Evan Dworkin about these four comic fans, and they basically four nerds. They like sci-fi comics, fantasy, horror movies, and they're specifically rendered to be like the worst comics fans ever. Like they're so petty, they get so angry at everything. You know, they don't want girls in their boys' club. Like, and I found this to be very entertaining, because thankfully, like I don't really associate myself with those kinds of fans, but like, it was like in any given moment, any panel, they're just like gritting their teeth and like sweating, and they're so upset. Like, I stayed up late reading till the very end, because I think it ended a few years ago. It was hilarious.
That sounds awesome.
And it reminded there was even like they tried making an anime series of it. Apparently, it used to air in Adult Swim. There's like a one episode like series of it that's pretty good, but it was one of those things where like I thought about those guys when I recently like I kind of this whole Alan Moore thing came up again. So people are like, you know, fuck Alan Moore. What is he talking? He made this. What a hypocrite! It's like they're not even caring to think about it. It's just like they have to protect themselves. It's like, you know, and I've seen some horrible fans. We all have, but I mean, I've seen firsthand, like, guys who are decades older than me just go on just embarrassing rants about stuff that's just not important. I mean, if anybody thought that I didn't like the Spider-Man Homecoming film, like, oh, Spider-Man fans are some
I don't
of the
even
worst,
want to know.
Spider-Man fans are some of the worst people I've ever met. Superman fans, and I don't want to say Superman fans, but like some Superman fans, when Man of Steel came out, I swear to God, it was like Vietnam. it was unbelievable. And you know, I can definitely sympathize with that when Dawn of Justice came out, but I think I just kind of stayed myself and didn't talk until you were on the phone. But there is very much an embarrassing degree of, you know, grown ass people who let it get to them so much. And it's like, you know, maybe, I don't know, because this certainly doesn't apply just to superhero comics or superheroes. You know, Star Trek is kind of seen as, you know, the go-to nerd fan stereotype. Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, which I have no knowledge of, honestly. But, I mean, I would imagine, I mean, maybe Game of, because Game of Thrones is pretty mainstream, and so is Walking Dead, so, like, fans of those, I guess, can kind of get, you know, kind of not suffer the stereotype of the fanboy. But, I don't know, because also, we're also dealing with a thing where, like, I guess he's also kind of fighting the mainstreamization, which is in the word, of, like, geekdom.
Sure.
Because you have, you know, like, the Star Wars, Force Awakens, the Avengers, the Marvel, the MCU, the Netflix shows, the Walking Dead television show, all this...
All of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Bow down. It's one of those things where, like, I remember hearing a podcaster resent the fact that, like, a pretty, you know, athletic, you know, kind of jockey-looking guy was wearing a Superman shirt, and he was like, you know, motherfucker, when I was in high school, I got beat up for that shit.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, like, on the one hand, yeah, I don't... It's one of those things where it's like, well, you're not a real family guy, but on the other hand, I don't care. Like, it's I don't know. Like what is the worst case scenario of adults getting to this club? I guess the Eltingville Club. I guess, you know, Gamergate. But I feel that I've seen so many people try to be more ingratiating and diverse, and there's always going to be men, you know, that's always going to be the sin of the human race, but there's also going to be, like, you know, people of color, and not to send the single white guys out, whatever, but, like, there's always going to be people who recognize the negative aspect of their cult and try to be better than that, and I don't know, like, there's plenty of people who have very fulfilling lives who are into this kind of stuff, like, I mean, I don't mind or care, or I'm not gonna say as an insult that, you know, Alan Moore worships snakes, and he's a practicing magician, all that kind of stuff.
Why would that be a bad thing?
Yeah, it's not a bad thing, but at the same time, it's like, this is also a guy who grew up for comic books. I mean, like, there is a correlation of special interests there. So, like, it's one of those things where it's like, are you better off, you know, being into something that you like, or are you better off kind of being somebody with no interests or hobbies, and like. You could do worse than, you know, be into something. And I'm very much going back and forth. I've not been liking my performance in this podcast lately, so, like, I'll just shut up. Like, what's your thoughts on it?
We'll just do it again. We'll do it live. Well, I mean, I kind of feel how you're ping-ponging around, but I guess it's kind of the complication of how do we define when fandom is good or bad, because it was kind of your instinct to go right to, like, essentially the Gamergate people who, you know, guys like on certain podcasts who just, like, went on and on about, like, Zendaya being cast as maybe Mary Jane. Like, that's probably not a good place to be.
Right.
But again, like, it's a little bit more nuanced, because it's not necessarily that they're obsessing over a detail in an adaptation of their favorite thing. It's that specifically it's about Zendaya being black, occupying what's supposed to be a white character. Like, that's the problem. Not necessarily that they're old or that they're obsessing about it, but the manifestation of that fandom kind of becomes problematic as a baseline, as that obvious token. And so I think it's not about quantity, or it's not a quantitative measure at all. I don't think that, because, like, I mean, for me, like, I am always so obsessed by fandom or just the idea of it. Like, ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to just be into something, which is a very, like, I don't know, it's like a Japanese mindset. Like, I don't know, it's almost like, it's like I wasn't actually really interested in anything, just I was interested in the idea of being interested in something. But
you're madder than,
like,
all
when
of
I was
us.
A kid, like, I was yeah, it's just really weird. Like, when I was a kid, I was really into, like, Godzilla. Like, that was my first thing. But it was hard to see Godzilla movies. Like, I could only ever see the Hesai movies on the Sci-Fi Channel when they were on. And so I never really saw a complete Godzilla movie until, like, last year. But I'm just kidding. That's hyperbole. But, but, like, you know, when – so because of that, when I become a fan of something, I go pretty hard, like with Ghost in the Shell and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Like, those are pretty much the two big ones for me. And for Ghost in the Shell, like I've written, I probably like a novel size for like, I've written like huge blogs for every episode of the show. And like I'd done videos and stuff. And for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I did like a whole fan video series for like a year. And so like there's definitely a point where I get a little bit insecure about that. And Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is an interesting consideration too, just because like I would say TV-14 rated TV show for on the CW, primarily directed at women apparently. But people who watch that show would not be insecure because it's not a geeky show or whatever, even if it's about those kinds of people. Which I think is interesting when you mention Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead, like those are so clutch, honestly, for AMC and HBO to have kind of fixed on, because they absolutely filter out all the geeky elements of their respective genres. Like there's no like zombie baby that gets punted around like in Dead Alive in Walking Dead. I guess there's dragons and zombies in Game of Thrones, but like it came pretty late. It was kind of drip fed. I feel like we've been kind of seeing that transition, of course, for years. Like my older sister would have never played original Xbox, but she plays like the Nintendo 64 whenever we break that out when we're all together as a family. And she's like really into Marvel stuff now and Star Wars. And not to say that she wouldn't have been, but it wouldn't have been right for her to have been back in the day. Like she would have been ostracized, which is maybe why that jock never wore that Superman shirt back in the day. Maybe they're not co-opted, but whatever, that's a weird theory. But like, you know, like the mainstreamization of pop culture has been strange. Like it started, I think, mostly on the wave of nostalgia, because I honestly think that the Bayformers movies were kind of instrumental in the mainstreamization of. I'm just gonna keep using that word that you invented.
There's a word for made up words. I forgot what it was.
I don't know. Somebody made it. And those movies were just about kids from the 80s or adults now. They're now a new demographic. And then Guitar Hero was about bridging the gap between music fans and video game fans. Halo and Call of Duty was just about getting jocks into things that weren't Madden. So what that honestly created was a lot of kind of bland material. Like, we didn't really see, the X-Men movies from the early 2000s are kind of the most crystal example, because they were so ashamed of themselves that it wasn't until First Class that you really got to see like colorful costumes and things like that.
Yeah.
Origins is just like so, like it was that, but without the quality. So it was just so ridiculous. Like Deadpool is so funny in that movie, but probably the only time it was funny.
Snap. I mean, I'd say that Spider-Man is like kind of like, like the rebirth of like the superhero idea. Like, we can get behind this. And like, once those movies are gone, we got to wait till like the kind of the Avengers to kind of get through there.
Yeah, I would say. But even Spider-Man, like, it was the same thing with Judge Dredd. Like, he never put on his helmet. Like, he would always end up with his mask off in those Spider-Man movies. Like,
I still don't know why that happened.
I know. I mean, there was some level of shame that was still going on, and we don't have that now. And we had to come through a certain period where we had this kind of intermediary material where, you know, Judge Dredd wouldn't wear his helmet. And then now in 2012, we get a movie where he does wear his helmet. And that's not a perfect movie either, but we're getting there. So I think, like, I don't even know what the hell I was.
I think a talking point is like, what is so wrong about being geeky? Because right. I feel that, like, you know, we always, you know, kind of have this self-deprecating kind of run-on joke about, you know, oh, we're so into this. And I think that, you know, it's mainstream now, but it's like, well, we're noticing that people like these things that are made, that are created so people could like them. It's like, wait a minute, like, why exactly is this so wrong? Now, of course, you know, we see stereotypes of, like, you know, insecure, you know, people who are antisocial, but, like, there are plenty of people who are insecure and antisocial that are not into, like, you know, pop culture stuff like Star Trek or comics or whatever. I mean, like, it's something that I feel that we've been convinced is a psychological detriment, and maybe that has to do with, like, you know, the lineage of the Senate hearings. Maybe that's to do with, like, you know, like the legacy of the 60s Batman show. Maybe that's something to do with, like, you know, like bad films like like barbed wire or ran the quest for peace or or Ghost Rider or something like that, that we know is bad. But like, I mean, everyone loved Spider-Man, the Spider-Man films. Everyone loved the Dark Knight movies. Everyone loved the Avengers. I mean, like, this is stuff that, like, you know, we hold, like, it's not unique to say, I love that movie. It's like, oh man, that movie, you know, it's good or whatever. Like, it's part of American culture that we celebrate. It's just like the James Bond films, whether you like James Bond or not. That's something that, like, is generally accepted as, you know, oh yes, film status, the Bond films, just these classic films. And, like, you know, that's kind of a geeky kind of thing too, you know. There's an entire podcast about, you know, like taking counts of how many times Bond killed somebody, you know, all the villains and all that kind of stuff. So, like, I guess I didn't necessarily mean for the show to turn into this, but it's like, you know, why is it so? Why is it so wrong to be a nerd about something? Like, why is it so wrong to be so obsessively into something that has been made that allows for that? You know, like how you know, there's so many different versions of these characters. How, you know, how dare you know that? Like, why is that so bad? Because obviously I'm not seeing that it is. So, but why do you think people find it to be so wrong? And why do we sort of allow that to be the narrative in our minds? Okay, yeah, I am kind of nerdy on this kind of thing. You know, like I admit that this is a flaw of mine that I have to accept. You know, character flaw. Why does it have to be a character flaw?
Well, I mean, Moore's argument is that it's because the storytelling is mature. So I think that could be our starting point there. Uh-huh. And when, you know, when Logan comes out, and I don't know if critics said this, but when they say things like, oh, this example, like, transcends the genre, it's the same argument. It's saying that comic books and superheroes are not mature enough, that they cannot be on this level. It has to become more than that to be appreciated. And maybe there hasn't really been a girth of superhero, not the opposite of a dearth. I don't know.
Swelling?
A swelling, yes. It hasn't been a swole.
this is very penis related.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe there hasn't been like an extensive body of work in popular media, which is just to say movies, which is the ultimate validating genre or medium, of, you know, mature storytelling examples. Because we really, I mean, we have Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, I think, honestly. Like, and Logan. I think those are kind of the three. Mm-hmm. Maybe. As far as people see them, of course.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so, like, how do we kind of approach that argument? How do we say that stories, superhero stories, can be appreciated by people who are over 30, which is the Logan's Run cutoff for otakus, and that that's okay because the storytelling is mature? Like, how do we define that part of it?
Well, I suppose I think what holds back that argument is, like, you know, they shouldn't be like this. I mean, there are people who just hate the Christopher Nolan Batman movies because they're like, oh, they're just too serious, they're just too realistic, and I never understand why, because they're just like the comics, except for his costume. I never get it, but like, they don't like seeing, you know, this made real, because it robs them of, you know, the imagination that is presented for them to co-op because it's the artwork, but like. I don't know. It's like why should I think also is, and this, I don't want to get away from the question, but like why should these things only be, you know, there's an immaturity of people dressing up in costumes punching people. Obviously, we understand that, but there's also enjoyment we get out of it. Is this ultimately saying that, like, you know, it's an immature thing to get excited about people punching people in the face in goofy costumes that don't really scare people in real life, and to like that is to be immature as you were when you were a child, and you should recognize that, but you know, I guess it's this, the emotion, the subnormal emotion that Moore is bringing up, but, you know, I mean, we recognize that it's fiction, you know, we do recognize that it's not something to be emulated, even though, okay, in fairness, there are, like, people who claim to dress up as superheroes.
Yes.
Which are in the streets. Uh-oh. I don't know. I think it still does what he said they used to do, spark the imagination. And I feel that, like, there's some wonderfully imaginative storylines. I mean, they can be very believable while still being, like, you know, part of the genre. I mean, I know that's true. That's why I'm still in it. I mean, the negative part of superhero fiction, I think, is that superheroes, they've never really seriously confronted the innate fascism of the genre. It's just right. vigilantes, you know, kind of taking apart. And there have been stories that have, you know, dipped their toe into that, but to really confront it would be to really risk the future of the genre, and they're not going to do that. But
yeah,
I think that, like, you know, like I mentioned before, like Ms. Marvel is a character who doesn't necessarily relish violence. There are characters who just I think that, like, there's a great story of Spider-Man JMS, of course, where he's, like, you know, kind of talking to, like, Mary Jane. He's like, you know, I honestly don't like fighting, you know, whatever. It's just something that I just made myself do every time I put this mask on. It's like stuff where, like, you know, if you're not going to confront a theme, that at least confront the humanity of somebody, and maybe that's also ignoring their psychology, which might not lead to a very nice place, but. I don't know. I feel that, like, there's baby steps towards not an egalitarian society, but, like, you know, an interesting treatise on the human psychology further down the line. But then again, maybe it's very obvious that these things have a finite level of observation in terms of, you know, what the human mind can do and what the human person might be able to come up with.
I mean, I hear you saying that as a comics fan, but, like, how infinite does a story have to be before it is mature or something like that? Like, Ms. Marvel, one of the Ms. Marvel stories being about it being a treatise on human psychology, like, maybe that's the extent to which a superhero can be told. But at that point, you just pick a different genre. Like I don't think something has to be disqualified. Oh my God, motorcycle. Everybody out of the street. But, like, I don't think that you have to disqualify a genre just because it's not up to the task of what other genres might provide. Like,
yes, I agree.
Yeah, it does what it does. And that doesn't mean it's limited, I don't think. Or any more than anything else, or that everything else is limited. I think some of this issue for Moore might be the fact that there's that element of power fantasy, adolescent power fantasy, as somebody might say, that might be arguably inherent, or that might be part of what created the genre. But again, like, I think you just have to explore the roots of where that power fantasy comes from, beyond just saying that it's bad and making a bunch of dark stuff about people shooting each other, like, as a kind of revision on it. Just, like, really explore, like, what a power fantasy might mean to those two Jewish kids writing about Superman. And like, I think he understands that, all that stuff, but it's weird how he kind of forgets that it's in a context of a society that is inherently sociological and therefore kind of open to the smart stuff or whatever. And I think that, you know, that shame is kind of a shame in itself. Like, my problem, like, I really like the Batman Begins, as people call it. My problem with The Dark Knight is not that it is mature, but that I think its maturity and its realism are two separate things that get conflated. And the fact that it's super realistic, I think, is a problem for a lot of people, because its Gotham City just looks like Toronto. Although I think
it's on the CW.
I think they did shoot that one in Chicago, but I mean, it doesn't look as messy and dumb as the one from the show Gotham, but it's still, like, it's not what Batman Begins presented, which was essentially this kind of steam Blade Runner version.
Yeah.
But that's not realistic. And so when people try to say that, like, it's like a Michael Mann movie, like, that's not a good comparison, because the movie is great up until Batman shows up and he just looks completely out of context in a Michael Mann film. And then I think he works in Dark Knight Rises again, but it's just, like, that middle part, like, it just tried to be a crime thriller, modern noir film. And I don't think that's what Batman Begins or The Dark Knight Rises excelled at. And so I think that, like, I don't think that Christopher Nolan was shirking the kind of fantasy or the fantastical elements of it on purpose or anything like that, or because he was ashamed of them. I just think it was kind of an accident of the story they were telling. But again, like, I think there is, like, that's, like, fantasy is not inherently childish, nor are things made primarily with children in mind. And maybe, like, this, like, super liberal, like, everything is accepted is too, like, broad as to actually be a concrete argument. But because part of this deals with contradiction and conflict, but I don't know. I mean, I just think it's weird. Like, saying that superheroes and comics are not for adult consumption is just, like, you don't know how, like, what they make of it in terms of intent and interpretation, right? Like, it's the same thing, like how he's a little bit insensitive when it comes to rape and storytelling. Like, yes, it is important for writers to be able to talk about that. But you also have to realize that, in essence, everyone is a writer, that when they have a voice in that discussion, they deserve theirs too. And, you know, writing Irreversible, the Irreversible Equation or Equity in Swamp Thing, like that's not a great story. Just because you wrote about rape doesn't make it good. I lost it.
Well, I'm glad that you read that part. There's an article we'll put up on the site that gets into like where he's confronted with, like, you know, his other stories have, like, you know, like rape and sexual abuse in it. The vigilante part of the story did. And his response, I thought, was very kind of dismissive. Whereas, yeah, like, you know, we should talk about it, you know, kind of compared to murder. He's not really taking into account, you know, for instance, how making rape more common in stories can be kind of psychologically harmful for the wrong kind of reader, or how some readers who have unfortunate experiences of that might feel triggered by it. But that's also kind of another issue. But I mean, I hear what you're saying, The Dark Knight, because I remember, like, when I first saw The Dark Knight, I walked out of that theater, I had no idea what to think about it. I was not feeling positive or negative. I was like, I have to see this movie again, because I cannot understand how I feel about it, because it was so unlike anything I was, like, expecting. And it was kind of like stark that, like, it was so realistic. It was, because Batman Begins is pretty straightforward in terms of, you know, kind of just being a superhero film, but this was so, like, kind of, like, believable that it was somewhat unnerving. And I've had entire podcast conversations with people who don't like it film because of that reason, because they feel that, like, Nolan is basically trying to, like, impress people smarter than him. Say, like, look at this, look what I did, look what I added to this superhero story is my ideas.
Totally.
Which I think is a very douchey thing to kind of just presume Christopher Nolan to do, because, yeah, he is, you know, kind of doing things that the movies haven't done before, but, like, because he has David Goyer, who's a comic fan, kind of telling him, well, in the comics there's this, so.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many references to, like, the comics that, like, yeah, there's no way he's not aware of that.
Right.
Leave Christopher Nolan alone. But I do get watching The Dark Knight and saying, you know, well, this is not really what I want to get out of a comic book film. There is an effect to it. But I feel that, like, it's just I think it's a negative. I feel like you don't have to, and I'm not speaking to you in general, but, like, you don't have to see things and get a negative takeaway from them. And I think that, like Moore sees the storytelling as obviously sees it much more limiting than it can be, because I guess he's either can be very, very silly or very, very violent. It can't really be kind of, you know, it can only be so thoughtful. And like, why does it have to be that way? I don't know. Because I've not read, because I know that, like, his other stuff, like Leaving Extraordinary Gentleman, is supposed to be, like, you know, a literary sort of, like, you know, imaginative team up on literary characters, you know, like Captain Nemo and Mina Harker and Invisible Man, all that kind of stuff. Like, top 10, or not top 10, but, like, Tom Strong is supposed to be, like, his take on like Doc Savage and sort of, you know, the pulp, you know, like John Carter character, like, kind of that approach to it. And he's always very much historically minded in his stories, but he's also kind of imaginative in that way. And I remember people on podcasts, you know, saying, you know, well, he's ragging on superheroes for being kind of derivative, but he's always doing this ripping off other characters, kind of, like, his own thing. And it's like, why is that not imaginative in itself? You know, like
right?
I don't know. It's kind of a knee jerk reaction, but I guess. For this to be seen as negative, there has to be negative examples. And we do have the examples in terms of, you know, bad fans and Gamergate and people who don't like women drinking milkshakes and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I swear to God, every time I go to Comic-Con, it's like Nirvana. Like, it's like a utopia. Every different type of person is there, and they're all celebrated. I mean, we very much enjoy this company as we're enjoying different things. Like, that's been going on for a very long time. And I know there is... That's not to dismiss, you know, people abusing cosplayers or whatever. I say wherever. But, like, that's not to dismiss, you know, the vestiges of the boys' club still being in those types of things. But it's not the overall takeaway experience in modern-day fandom. The majority of fandom, they lead very wholesome, healthy lives. And I kind of just need to see some more, like, you know, like, Elliot Rodger wasn't, you know, to my knowledge, a gigantic, you know, Donovan Grant level comic book fan. I don't, you know, there is much more danger in people sort of being politically minded, in the wrong way of, you know, kind of seeing history and kind of seeing things from that kind of perspective, rather than reading Death of Superman. And I don't know. I mean, like, he's basically kind of saying that, like, people who have great love for this sort of stuff are basically wasting their emotion in that way. Maybe, but I don't know. I mean, I've never. There are definitely times where I feel, you know, well, I'm really wasting my time kind of doing this or whatever, or I don't like the fact that so much of my mental energy contributes to this thing, which is often seen as, you know, immature and silly. But as an adult, I kind of realize, you know, that's sort of on someone else's kind of thing to kind of really speak of me, and it's on me to kind of recognize that I have a lot going for myself, I think, more so than that. And, you know, I feel fine in it. I remember when I was a teenager, I was working, and I was getting off work, and someone said, "Oh, where are you going?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to go to the comic shop." And they're like, "Oh, you like comics or whatever?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, I do." And like, "Oh, you're not bothered by that?" I was like, "No." And like, that was like the end of the conversation, and that was it. And like, my life continued.
Hey, what?
Yeah, they're getting ready to like kind of laugh about it. Then like, I kind of like wasn't in the mood to like think about it too much, and that was it. It was like, I guess they admit, I don't know. Not to say this is a big deal or whatever, but they kind of like learn to not think about it in that way. And I don't know. It's just. I used to feel more. I guess when I was in school, I didn't really kind of bandy it about unless I found other kids who were into it. But as an adult now, it's not. I don't necessarily bandy about it either. But it's also like something where like people enjoy that I'm into comics. Oh, you're the comics guy or whatever. And that's not necessarily something to brag about, but it's one of those things right now where it's like I feel that. When things are, you know, things are accept are more accepted, then there's more positivity and happiness, rather than a lack of, I guess, you know, adult emotion or something. Again, I'm rambling, so you go.
Well, I guess it's just about like how he perceives the product of, or the reaction, I guess, the response in the reader who is overage, like, or, you know, quote unquote overage. Like, what is he like? How does he measure a proper response or something? Like, does he just want everybody to be reading Victorian novels or, you know, penny dreadfuls as they were back in the day? Like,
right.
At some point, every medium was marginalized, but that's a different conversation. And I think that the element of social justice is kind of an undeniable specter in this conversation, because it is a very definitive inroad to the justification of media, that being identity, that you can watch Citizen Kane and Casablanca, or you could watch some dumb comedy from the 80s, and you might get more out of that dumb comedy. Or rather, you could watch, like, Jane the Virgin or something, which is, like, a very, like, modern show that's not always up for the Emmys that a lot of people, you know, rightfully think it should be. Critically acclaimed, but kind of marginalized in itself. And you might see yourself in that show as a Mexican-American woman, perhaps, and where you wouldn't get anything out of Citizen Kane. And Citizen Kane is considered a higher work of art by, like, who now? Like, the AFI? Right. Like, the Academy? Like, who cares about that now? Jane the Virgin means something to you. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, perhaps. All that stuff. Like, again, like, you define your own taste, and that's what becomes important. And so I think that there is healthy fandom and an unhealthy fandom, but for me, that line is just about when it turns you into that kind of Gamergate style character. Because I don't really care about, like, oh, you obsess about Pokemon, so you, like, decorate your walls and, like, all of the Pokemon cards or some shit, or, you know, you blog way too much about Ghost in the Shell. Like, it just consumes your thoughts and you can never sleep. Like, that's fine. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, right. I don't give a shit about you destroying yourself because of your fandom any more than I give a shit about, like, people who get gay married. If I'm speaking from Harrison, like, 10 years ago, like, that's obviously a little outdated at this point. Anything, like,
yeah.
What you do in the privacy, you know, between two consenting adults, whatever, all that bullshit, not bullshit, is, it applies here. And then the other thing is, but, like, yeah, again, to go back to The Dark Knight one more time, like, I would say that, like, Logan was not that kind of realistic, But it was mature in terms of violence and emotion. I think you can have one without the other. And so I think that it wasn't so much that The Dark Knight was like trying to define what maturity meant. It was just kind of this happy accident where it was a very mature movie and it was also a very realistic movie. But those two don't necessarily equal the same thing. And so I would kind of like – I would ask you, like, are there stories that match – because when we were talking about, like, you know, comics and superhero media for kids and for adults, like, we were kind of – I feel like there was a point I was trying to – or I was going to make, rather, about, like, are there stories that are content unsafe – but also like super emotionally mature in terms of like, would they pass the Alan Moore test that cannot be in the hands of children or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm trying to think. Right away, like the things are, you know, this should not be in the hands of children. Like the Punisher Max comics, I have no business being in children's hands or really anybody's hands.
Right, but those are not like they would not pass the Alan Moore test.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think like something that's actually like, really really good. Maybe like I don't know something like maybe Akira, whatever. But of course, that's a manga.
Oh,
but
yeah, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's quite very it's very violent, but it's also, you know, it's very 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 strongly told story. I mean, I'm trying to think of like something that hasn't so much. It's not as much comparable to Watchmen, but it's like, you know, violence or whatever. I don't know. There's plenty of like violent books out there. I would say Vigilante is a pretty adult comic, especially by the end it was. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised like what they got away with in terms of like sexual content, because this is like a mainstream DC comic book. And it did have a suggestion for mature readers tab label on it, but it was still a guy in a costume. I would say that like that's a very strong story about the nature of vigilantism that I wouldn't give to a kid, but I would probably give to a teenager, like a 13, 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And then I think on the flip side, something like Astro City would be kind of high on emotional maturity but low on violence, and I wouldn't give that to a kid either.
Right. Yeah. Professor Osvaldo Oyola has been writing about Astro City lately. It's been very, very interesting. Now, I would agree with that too. That's pretty high-minded storytelling. I would say stuff like that. Stuff like I'm trying to think of the most mature instances. Like, you know, stuff like stuff that's not necessarily violent. I would even say some like Spider-Man comics of like the early 2000s. Which are really dang good, especially like the Paul Jenkins stuff. He's another British author. Wrote a very, very like kind of like mournful Spider-Man that I really enjoy. That I think like his emotions, like, you know, might be kind of too subtle for a kid, but might be interesting kind of see sort of the scope of human emotion in a superhero that I can't say I've seen elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that like that sort of thing, and maybe more is always sort of reacting to, like, you know, the knowledge that superheroes are being reflected in the films as basically kind of, you know, like action-packed slugfests, which of course are not, or, you know, or it's Marvel, you know, it's like knee-slapping comedies. But, and maybe that doesn't necessarily reflect the potential of the medium. He also just thinks that, like, you know, comics just do things better than movies. But, I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, Civil War, whether you like it or dislike it, I think that, like, it said something that superhero movies generally don't. And it said it loud enough to where it sparked a conversation, at least demonstrated a certain intelligence behind the potential of superhero stories. Whether it's set for or not, it at least had enough awareness to kind of make itself memorable. And maybe it sucks that doesn't come every single film, but why should it have to? Because this was sort of escapism. It's like, you know, can you really escape in a superhero comic that's Watchmen, or can you really, or are you wasting your time reading something that's like, you know, Batman, whatever the stupid issue was where Batman and Robin go back in time to meet see Captain Gordon or whatever, which was kind of awesome.
Oh my God. The note about like superhero movies being like not as complex as the comics is like, it's just it like, not to say that it's wrong, but it's kind
like
of
all
flawed.
Movies.
Well, I mean, it's just that the idea that like, the superhero genre dominates American comics, like almost like 100%. Like obviously they're like whenever there's not a superhero comic, it's seen as kind of fringe or independent. And that's not the case in movies. Like right now, superhero movies are very kind of like one thing, which is kind of the action thriller. And that's fine for now. But in the future, it will kind of become more diverse. I mean, look at what's happening with like giant monster movies. Like there was Colossal, I think, with I want to say Anne Hathaway. I don't know what that was about, but it was not it was not Pacific Rim. Or even Shin Godzilla was not, you know, the American Godzilla. Like at some point, that diversity enters in, but still superhero movies, and it's hard to believe, but are kind of a minority in movies right now, as most genres are. But yeah, and I guess like when we say that we wouldn't give these stories to kids because they are too literary or something, like I would kind of backpedal on that. I think that I think you can always have a mature story for all ages, that and I just think that content ratings have no place there. You can never rate that kind of element or that part of a story as along a kind of a track of like age acceptability or whatever. Like, cause it's like, what's the concern that like they wouldn't understand it? Like, that's not really a big deal, cause you never know what a kid is going to get out of a story. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know. I feel like
I agree with you, because I'm thinking of stuff like Rose's Scabbard from Steven Universe, which is an incredibly mature episode that I cannot that would just be impossible to really maybe at one point, but no, I can't see it being done the same way in the 90s. Even though in the 90s did have pretty mature episodes, I mean, like Batman the Animated Series could be pretty mature, but it was always kind of done in like, I mean, it was one of the most mature cartoons of its time. For kids, you know, not without getting into adult animation, but I feel that like Steven Universe has sort of a frankness with its emotional content that really gets into adult territory, but it's done in a way that like kids can very much readily get. Which is kind of crazy because you know it's made for kids, but it's also adults I think feel from it stronger, but kids can understand it. I don't know. It's one of those things. I remember. Like we were talking about how, you know, it's tagged for its kind of gay content. Like there's an episode of The Simpsons, Homerphobia had a gay character that they tell in the commentary that, like, you know, usually they have a lot of, you know, network notes and stuff like that. That's kind of a few lines. Like Bart Simpson can't say scumbag or whatever, but like with that episode they had two full pages of like single space notes, which basically ended with this episode is not acceptable for broadcast. And at the time the Fox network of broadcast and inspectors, this had changed presidents, and once the new president came in and reviewed the episode, they said it's acceptable for broadcast. It was all about politics. It's one of those, because you know, all the notes were about, you know, kind of the mention of the concept of homosexuality rather than anything offensive. So it's one of those things where it's like social mores are always sort of evolving or devolving. but you know, an audience is always very much people aren't always so easy to peg and decipher and kind of, you know, determine what's best for them or what's not. Like a lot of teenagers read Watchmen when they were younger and probably are have very successful careers today. Not maybe specifically because of that, but you know, they've thought about things in different ways. So yeah. I think that like to kind of write off that potential, and granted, you know, not everything is Watchmen, obviously. You know, some people have read I don't know, the Kree Skrull War from the Avengers comics in the 70s, and you know, they still like that as adults today, but they're not worse for it. I guess the biggest culprit in this conversation is the stereotype of the comic book fan, you know, more so than anything else. Like that's the biggest like detriment, because you know this fat, unhealthy, mean kind of, you know, caricature of the human race, which
comic
is,
book guy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there is absolutely a truism to that. There is that is a thing. But I have a lot of friends who are comic fans, and they are basically fine. Like Josh is like the inverse of a comic fans. You know, he's a big jolly guy who's very, very charming and quick witted, who knows more. He's forgotten more about comics than I'll ever know.
Yeah.
But like he is not mean at all. So it's like you kind of have to like, you know, I think. I don't want this to be another episode where, like, you know, communication is the key, but, like, I feel that, like, that might be creeping up.
Yeah, as it always does. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that is very true. And I think it's just about how we need to kind of redefine what it is to be a fan. And obviously that's like the old project that frightens the originators or the original fans or whatever. But, you know, I guess like my older sister is kind of a nerd now, or a Star Wars fan or whatever. I guess I am a Star Wars fan now. It's just I think that like you don't have to jump over the wall in boot camp in order to, like, you don't have to pass a test to become a fan or anything like that. And no. I know that like forums and boards are always about that. Like, can you name five anime that wasn't aired on Adult Swim? It's like, it's a, they're always doing stuff like that. And I think that that's like so weird and dumb. And it does have to do with the kind of the uselessness of fan identity. Like, I remember there was a great line by Zach Bershey on the ANN cast where they were talking about video games, and I think they were talking about, like, you know, toxicity online. And he was like, it's really cool that you're a video game fan. That, like, that's like your reason for like not having a personality or something. It's like, it is essentially like, you know, people swap out. It's like they're Indiana Jones in front of the thing in the beginning, and they swap out a bag of sand, and like that's their fandom. It's like, instead of a personality, that was the worst metaphor. Like,
that's so mean.
Worst delivered metaphor. But it's just like, it's people who kind of are dicks about their fandom. It's like, yeah, they definitely ruin it for other people. They ruin the idea of fandom. I much prefer the idea that fandom can kind of be like a MacBook Air, in essence, that it can just kind of be this thing that you just have. You know, it's just, or not a MacBook Air, but like it's like your iPhone. Like, it's like a gadget or something. Like, it's right. Just this everyday thing that you just kind of use, and maybe it would have been weird to an earlier generation, but it's not really anymore. And that has to be a good thing. And I think it's also a good thing not only because it includes diverse people, but also for the more arguments that storytelling can have this utility that you never ever imagined, which has, again, I guess, to do with identity, but also like bringing people together. Again, that communication thing.
Well, I think that like what I'd like to end on, because I said starting out that like I do think it's worth the conversation. I do think there is a talking point of, I think as branched out as comic books have shown to be, there is a sort of, you know, kind of mediocrity in the thoughts of, you know, oh well, you know, so and so has to, you know, fight this or whatever. I do feel that like in terms of the storytelling with superhero comics, there is a sort of recycled, regurgitated, hero fights villain kind of thing that I wish could evolve a bit. And I know that kind of sells, you know, comics or whatever, but like much of the main story, like a lot of the like the kind of, you know, story arcs and summer events or whatever that tend to happen, I really don't care about. I'm always more kind of interested in sort of, you know, the like ongoing narrative, you know, the Spider-Mans, the Robins, the Nightwings, the kind of the books would kind of, you know, kind of follow the character rather than gear up for the crossover where they fight this character and they deal with this instant. Like, and I do think like the over reliance, and I know those still books, but the over reliance of that does limit the potential for the genre, which I think I would agree with more that like that targeting that towards adult older readers, like that's kind of suck. I feel that there is something to be said about that, but I think as we talked about tonight, you don't. There is a very it's a very limited view that he's relying on in terms of, you know, comic readers that and the comic book superhero potential that I think, you know, kind of rounds out his argument that doesn't make it hold up to almost 2 hours worth of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, sure, comic books and superheroes could do more. I mean, everybody could do more in terms of genre stuff. I guess for my final note, not really related, is when you talked about that comic that was about nerds, I feel like that is kind of a subgenre in especially manga and anime where it's about otakus or whatever. And like The Big Bang Theory is kind of about nerds. And I always like despise whenever nerds are kind of depicted in media just generally, just because, not because like they're so dumb or they hate women or whatever, but because they don't have a specialty. They just like everything. Like Sheldon will talk about like astrophysicists and also the Lord of the Rings. I'm like, sure, some people are like that, but when you say this guy likes fantasy and science fiction. I'm like, okay, well, that's not me at all. Like, I fucking despise fantasy. If I'm a dick about one thing in my fandom, it's that fantasy and science fiction are not at all related. Like, they don't even have anything to do with each other at all. And I know that a lot of authors write both, and, like, they are very related, but I just cannot reconcile those two in my mind.
I'm kind of the same way where it's like, you know, oh, I'm such a comics fan, I don't know a dick about Thor.
Right, exactly.
Nor do I care.
Right.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, you know, when I was in college, a lot of my friends said, oh, you should watch The Big Bang Theory, you'll like it. And I've heard that, like, you know, it's basically like, you know, like, it's funny because they like things that we don't like or something.
It is even worse than you have imagined. I mean, I guess you saw that video, so you pretty much know, but yeah, it's awful.
Oh, like the misogyny?
Yeah, yeah. And then Young Sheldon is like straight up a drama, I feel like. I've only seen a little bit of it, but it's just like they're going completely different with that one. It's just like, oh my god.
Was it The Wonder Years?
I know, right? It's just like, my god, guys. But, yeah.
All right.
There was a lot of ruckus when I was working on Daredevil as it found its voice, because the violence was so harsh, and because people were getting cut up. Mostly it was the harshness of it, the way that had a strong reaction from people, because it was as if I brought whiskey into a playground or something. In comic books, in superhero comics, people have wasted an awful lot of creative energy and hard work looking for kids who aren't there. The audience who read Daredevil was not juvenile. They weren't. And I got this character who'd been pretty, I mean, I think even the most generous people would call it a grade B character. He was the poor man's Spider-Man. And everybody knew that. But I kind of saw this guy as being something much cooler.
So we have an email.
Yeah.
Have an email from a returning listener, one Michael Ridge. And Michael writes, hey guys, this is in regards to the white people voting against their best interests. He tells it, no one acts against their perceived self-interest. Hi guys, I laid out my thesis in the title. If you think someone is acting against their own interests, you don't understand how they see the world, or you are only focusing on one factor in the person's decision. Michelle Obama, in a recent speech, said that any woman who didn't vote for Secretary Clinton voted against her voice. One of those voters may have believed that the secretary was a criminal and would be as dangerous as president. And, while Mr. Trump clearly had little respect for women, he wouldn't take any major actions against women. She may have balanced these and other factors in making her final decision on her vote. When Michelle Obama tells the voter she made the wrong choice, the voter's response should be resentment that someone says she was wrong, hearing a loud subtext of stupid here, without addressing any of the other factors that caused her to vote the way she did. If someone asks me to name my favorite Marilyn Monroe, I say How to Marry a Millionaire. If the questioner then says that she expected me to name Some Like It Hot because it's clearly a better movie and a regular movie watcher like me should have picked it, I resent it because I can't be wrong about my own opinion. Some Like It Hot is the better movie, but that wasn't the question. I asked to name my favorite. So every discussion that doesn't include multiple factors and recognize that information and disinformation are fighting for the voters' attention throughout the campaign is going to come off as some privileged person calling me stupid because I don't think the same way. Remember how much of a to-do was made of Secretary Clinton's joking reference to a basket of deplorables? Is this a rant? I've always wanted to do a rant. Thank you, Michael. This is an interesting feedback. I think this is the first time we've had a feedback. Maybe Jason and the Gun thing. That goes against what we said. I know Harry has a pretty invested interest in responding to this, so do you want to respond to this first?
Sure. And my problem with this email is that he asks us to look for nuance and voter motivations but doesn't actually provide his own. You're not part of a hive mind, so don't act like it by expecting other people's motivations to apologize for your own, especially when those motivations are, for the most part, defenses against criticism. I mean, like, Donald Trump is a reality, and by this point, one well understood. But that being said, I know that voting for him doesn't invalidate your humanity, because very few things actually do, which is more for my sake than any wrongdoer in question. But because I know that, I'm not the one you have to prove that to. In an ironic twist, it's millennials who will be the last generation to sympathize with Trump voters to any extent, because after us, the 2016 voters become history, and future historians are going to smooth this narrative out like we do for everything that came before us. I'm interested in chasing after nuance in this discussion, despite that, however, but learning the full scope of Trump voters who seem more inexplicable with each passing day, utterly convicted alongside their president, it's a journey, and a discussion like last episode, is a starting point. You know, we begin with generalizations and then we narrow towards specifics if we ever return to that topic. And also the equation between voting and choosing your favorite movie is pretty telling, and that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah, Michael, I mean, we very much appreciate you writing in, but I'm we're inclined to disagree just because I don't From my end, I feel that like this is treating voting as more subjective than objective, because I feel that like it's straight up objective that Donald Trump's the worst president and was obviously a worse president. We're not saying that people, you know, didn't have problems against Hillary Clinton, but there was the fact of the matter is that like, you know, whatever their problems with Hillary Clinton made them vote against their interests rather than they had reasons that they were doing it in their best interest. But that is because the phrase voting against one's interests is sort of an objective phrase. It's not really – that doesn't really allow opinion or personalization in there. It's sort of kind of stating that as sort of after the fact. So, yeah, I agree. It's not kind of the same. I think we're kind of coming at this a different way. And it's not really something that I agree on that, like, you know, we're kind of – not taking account, you know, the different factors, because the fact of the matter is there were factors, the overarching factors that like they voted for Donald Trump, and that was not in the best interest, especially if they're, you know, from lower end parts of the country, if they are trans, if they are from places which Donald Trump has now sicked his focus against. So I think that's one of those things that was like, you know, like blacks for Trump, that's absolutely voting against their interests, because Trump is very much in favor of stop and frisk. He's very much unsympathetic towards police brutality against blacks disproportionately. He's very much, you know, a proponent of, you know, what about black on black crime? Like, he's very much that kind of guy. So like, there's not really an argument that can be presented to me where it's like they did not vote against their interests, because they very much did. Any sort of argument about why they didn't like Hillary Clinton doesn't matter. Because like it's Hillary Clinton's not an issue. She lost. What they did do is vote for somebody who is basically out to destroy them. I still very much appreciate your email, but that's sort of like how we're kind of standing against you. I was gonna say like that, but like, you kind of how we sort of see things.
I mean, to be clear, like, I think we have to kind of separate Donald Trump's sexism from his actions, and he has taken major actions against women. I mean, he's constantly trying to defund Planned Parenthood, which would kill a lot of people if that ever came to pass. And like, unless people just stop having sex, which frankly I would agree with you that would be a good idea, but I'm not gonna say people should actually do that.
No, never.
So yeah, you know, I mean, the Women's March wasn't an accident or something like that. Like, you know, there's the Billy Bush stuff, and then there's the actual attempts at legislating against women's interests.
Yeah, I mean seriously, it's like this stuff, him being slow to condemn the KKK and all that kind of stuff, and David Duke saying Trump is our president, like, that's not, you know, that just doesn't happen. There's cause and effect.
Yeah, and we knew all that going in. Like, that wasn't, oh, he didn't become a bad person after we knew he was, or after he became president. Like, we knew all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway.
Yeah, so that's our thoughts on that, and continuing thoughts. But if anybody else has thoughts, or if Michael Richmond was to add anything else, not that this is a conversation we want to, you know, have back and forth in the email section, but opinions all, email in at qnoanswers@gmail.com.
And for next week?
Yeah, what about that? So for next time, how do we sell the future? How do we bring about real change? How do we make change real? How do we bring about people from the political aisle, across political aisles? How do conservatives talk to liberals? How do liberals talk to conservatives? In the latter, it's very biased. But a lot of times we talk about conflict and what we need to do, kind of, you know, extinguish that conflict. So how do we do that? What is essentially is that the final conflict that we solve to bring about the future, and how do we solve that? And how do we sell that?
Earth final conflict.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So if you have thoughts on that episode, on this episode about Alan Moore, about superheroes, about superhero movies, comic books, Steven Universe with his girlfriend.
Everything that we like.
Jade the Virgin.
Yep.
Please, I beg of you, email in at youknowanswers@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. And with that, Donovan, do you have any comics to recommend?
Yes. What was the last issue of Detective Comics? Oh, man. The Detective Comics is so good. It actually is ironic because like I was assigned a series of articles by the main man of the Batman universe. So I would recommend reading this week's issue. I guess it would be like last week's issue of Detective Comics. Or I guess, no, when I get this out this week, which is like 965. And once you read that, read my series of articles on the Batman universe, Why Everyone Loves the Drake, a spotlight on people's fan favorite Robin, only because it's all connected. But that's kind of a fanboy thing. I'll actually recommend what's a good series I could recommend? Oh, Cassandra Cain comics. Read those.
Yep, always.
Absolutely. What about you?
The comic that I've always been trying to read is Monster. I think that's kind of the go-to.
Like, I heard about that.
Yeah, I mean, if any anime was going to be shown on HBO, it would probably be Monster. That's what I hear. But I bought the collected edition of that first volume, and it's huge. It's a brick. So I didn't bring it to LA with me. I didn't even start reading it. So if they put that on digital, then I'll be right there. But Pluto is good, and I think that's available on digital.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm always in search for more manga to read. I was talking to my cousin last week, and he was basically kind of recommending me all the shonen stuff. But we shall see. All shonen stuff is really long these days.
Yeah, I know.
Freaking Naruto is like 70-something volumes.
God, and it ended too. It's not even like One Piece or anything.
It did so. Although I'm always like every whenever a new chapter comes out, Hajime no Ippo, chapter 1,100 and whatever.
Jesus.
Will he ever beat Ricardo Martinez?
Oh my God! At least Guts got off the boat. Damn.
Awesome. Alright guys, until then we shall talk to you next episode.
I don't know shit about comic books, but if I had to choose, I would be blue. Swinging from the ceiling with my crown to the ground, I'm chilling. Civilized till I go to war with the villains. So meet your Victor Von Doom when I'm on soon. Rain down pain on 4, 5, 6 at a time, green line trains. Genius, summa cum laude. Ever since Xavier found me, it took me away from the folks who clown me. It put similar types around me, from human to mutant, one with my surroundings, to explain claws and the fangs that are crowning. Something like a Thundercat, so it's no wonder that if I cross paths with Chitara, she's gone to tomorrow, but that's kinda ill, so it's back to the skills. X-Men, X them, no popping pills.